Marjorie, thank you very much. As always, thanks for the invitation. Hope everyone had a great summer. Am I audible on there? I so don't like microphones. Okay. Our topic for this morning, in light of Rosh Hashanah coming up, is why forgive? And what I want to talk about is learning to forgive others or the benefits of forgiveness. And I want to start actually with a story of someone who could not, did not forgive. And I don't know if the rabbis at either here or other synagogues you've been to use props in their speeches. But I always enjoyed, when I was in the synagogue rabbinate, I always enjoyed finding a good prop. And the best prop I ever found was actually for a Yom Kippur speech. It's now about 10 years ago. A fellow in my synagogue was a financial advisor, and he gave me the prop. The prop was a huge, huge bag of $100,000 American. $100,000 American shredded. And I started my speech on Yom Kippur. I had arranged, for those who are familiar with the laws of Muktzah, there were ways to deal with that. The bag was okay for handling on Yom Kippur. But I started my speech up in the front at the pulpit, and I walked down from the front, from the pulpit, and we had a center aisle down the middle, and I walked down the aisle holding this bag so that everybody could see it and explaining where it had come from. This financial advisor had an associate he worked with who had a client who was an elderly woman whose children had started fighting about the inheritance. And she had the sense from them that they really just wanted her money and that the relationship was non-existent beyond what they wanted from her. And so she was going to show them. And so she went out and bought a shredder. And she withdrew all this cash and she ran it through the shredder. And if her financial advisor had not found out about it, she had much more that she was going to put through the shredder. He's, convinced her that there were other ways to deal with this. And you hear it, and on the one hand you can't help laugh, and on the other hand you can't help cry. Like, think of all the people you could have helped with this. Like, you could have given it away to anything if you didn't want, if you wanted to make a point to the kids. Like, there were so many different things. But that such was the anger that she felt, and she couldn't get over it. She couldn't get past it. And so that, obviously provided a very important theme, I think, for Yom Kippur in terms of people's relationships and what we do to each other. But the truth of the matter is that, less dramatically, people have trouble forgiving. Why should we forgive? What's the benefit of forgiving? Makes you feel better. Sorry, was that your business? Yeah. Personally, it's good for you. Right? That's sort of the first stop in terms of why you would want to forgive, is simply that it's better for you. It gets rid of stress. There's a line, I'm going to get it, I won't get it exactly right, but something along the lines of, why would you let someone else live rent-free in your head? Right? As long as you can't let go, you're the one who's going to be the victim of it, and that's certainly true, although a little bit hard to carry out. But I also have another story that I particularly enjoy. This one comes from a Rabbi Yisachar friend who lives in Baltimore. He's a rabbi at a yeshiva there, and I once saw a video in which he told the following story, and this was a great story with phenomenal advice. I'm not usually a storyteller, but I love this story. He tells a story about a fellow who came to him one day with a problem. His problem is this. He got up in the morning one day. Sure. He went out to get his newspaper, brought it inside, and noticed that it wasn't folded quite as crisply as usual. He thought that was odd. read the paper. Next day, goes out to get his paper, and again, it's not as crisp as it usually is. Third day, he goes out, same thing. Fourth day, he gets up early, looks out the window as the fellow comes down, delivers the paper, and sees his neighbor from next door come to his house and take the paper, goes back into his house, 20 minutes later, comes out and puts it down. Neighbor is reading his paper. So he goes to Rabbi Friend and he says, "Rabbi, what should I do?" What would you have advised him to do? Let him read it. What else?
Nothing.
Yeah. So there is the advice that Rabbi Friend gave. Rabbi Friend's advice was, buy your neighbor the paper. Buy him a subscription. So look, if you're going to start something with him, every time you step out the door of your house and he steps out the door of his house, your kids come home from school and you pick them up at the bus stop, you're going out shopping, whatever it is, every time you see him, that's going to be in your head, it's going to be in his head, you're going to be miserable, far more than the cost of a newspaper. You want your newspaper to be crisp and clean? So get him a subscription. He'll take the hint, and that'll be that. That was his advice. And as far as the fact that this other fellow, hold on one second, is benefiting from, you know, your largesse, the reality is that you are better off when you have a line item in your budget that is what he calls shalom money. Right? Peace money. If I can spend X on shoes, and I can spend Y on trips, I can spend a certain amount, whatever it is that I can afford to allocate, that will be to buy shalom, to buy peace for the year. That was his advice. Yes?
I was going to say, offering him a subscription lets him know that you know what he was up to.
Right, I was wondering about that also. Right, and I definitely hear it. I think perhaps the point was raised that it could cause an embarrassment and also, frankly, lead to strife when you buy him a paper. The question is, this fellow is sitting there getting agitated day after day as he reads his paper and he knows someone else has read it and it's not crisp and so on. So, you know, that could lead to other problems. In other words, you're in a bad situation to begin with. The question is, how can you come out with the least bad solution? That's really, I think, what it's about. Yes?
A lot of this hinges on the relationship between the two neighbors. If they are good neighbors, then buying the subscription would probably be taken in the proper light and they would both laugh about it. If they are not good neighbors, it could create resentment.
I agree. This has to be implemented carefully. And I think buying it for him really has to be done in the context of a gift, really. Like you have to say,
a little bit sensitive situation.
Yes, I would agree with that.
I was just going to say, you could also give him this newspaper subscription anonymously.
Mm-hmm. You could try that. Good luck. I don't think that'll be anonymous very long. Yes?
You could also go out a little bit earlier and pick up your newspaper.
There's an idea. Get up early and pick up your paper before the neighbor gets it. It's going to start an arms race. Okay.
Okay, so the newspaper probably isn't such a big deal, and okay, you can do that. But let's say your kid accidentally hits a ball into their yard and he tears a piece off your kid. And how much forgiveness can you give, or should you be giving? Does it depend on
It's a good question. The question is, what if somebody else has done something that is terrible? The case that Betty just gave is where your child hit the ball into their yard, went over to get the ball, and they give him a harsh rebuke, something that's out of line with what's deserved. You could easily imagine situations that veer further and further towards either danger or abuse or something like that. And there are lines where you have to say, no, this I can't forgive. And I'm going to come back to that actually briefly a little bit later. So yes, this has to be done with seichel. It has to be done with intelligence. Hopefully we have. If not, we can borrow from others. But the reality is that I think even though we recognize the value of forgiving, at the same time, we have difficulty doing it. Right? The Torah is filled with examples of people who just can't let go. I gave you on the sheet one of the bullet points. Pharaoh is an example of somebody who literally cannot let go. There's no way he's going to allow the Jews to leave Egypt. Haman is another one, the villain of the Purim story, where he can't forgive the fact that Mordechai will not bow down to him. And inevitably, the examples biblically of people who can't forgive lead to their demise. It never ends well for the person who can't forgive. And yet, we all know cases. Ourselves, our families, our social circles, whatever. We all know people who have difficulty forgiving. And I think one reason why we have difficulty forgiving is because we have weak motivations for letting go. Meaning, if the best motivation I can come up with for forgiving is it's for my own good, it's easy to defeat that. Because I'll say, well, if I forgive them, then what are they going to do to me next? I have my anger, insecurity, all sorts of things that undermine that. You tell me, forgive for the sake of the future. I can't necessarily think of a future relationship in the moment when I am angry. We need stronger motivations for forgiving. Yes?
Pride is very important. You are proud to admit that, okay, I'm too proud to forgive you because my own idea is wrong. So you should come first.
Right. Absolutely. Pride is huge. And there are all sorts, actually, of Talmudic stories about people who would not forgive and would not go to each other as a result of pride. So what I want to set up is a stronger positive motivation for forgiving based on a difficult passage in the book of Genesis. If you take a look at source number one, please. These are classic verses from the creation of human beings. Day 6 of creation. And God said, "Let us make man in the image and form we have designed." Now, I'm using Rashi's commentary from the 11th century when I translate it that way. You have likely heard those words translated differently. Instead of "let us make man in the image and form," tselem and dmut are the Hebrew words, but "let us make man in the image and form we have designed," instead it's "let us make man in our image, in our form." And as it's put further along, you'll see, well, let's read it. "And he will rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, the beasts of the entire land, and all of the crawling creatures that crawl upon the land. And God created man in his image." In the image created by God, he created him. That, again, is a commentary of Rashi. The literal translation would be, "in the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." Why is Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, the commentator Rashi, why does he insist on translating it as "in the image created by God" instead of "the image of God"? Why doesn't he want to say "in the image of God"? Can't see God. There's no image to be seen. Jewish thought has taught for centuries and centuries, millennia really, that there is no image of God. There are biblical verses that attest to that. So how can the text talk about the image of God? So Rashi's answer, fitting in very nicely with the Hebrew, is that it is the image created by God, the image designed by God. It's not God's image in the sense that it's what he looks like. It's God's image in the sense that it is the one he created. That's one approach. That's Rashi's approach. Other commentators suggest other ideas. I brought you source number two, in which the classic commentator Malbim, Rabbi Meir Lailush, says that the image of God is free will. He says, via the neshama, neshama is the soul, right? Via the neshama of life placed in him, in the human being, from the higher spirit, meaning what has been handed down by God, he, the human being, became a nefesh chaya. That's the term used in the Hebrew. This is what gives him life and nourishes him. Therefore, his life is different from that of a beast, for its root is from the upper realms. And therefore, he has the power of free choice. For thus he was created in the image of God, as it is written, let us make man in our image. And so the other powers of his spirit are higher than those of other creatures. Human beings are made to be different from the animals, and what makes them different is the power of free choice, and that's what it means to be in God's image as opposed to being modeled on the beasts. So that's the suggestion he brings. Others bring this this idea as well. It's not unique to him. So freedom of choice, the fact that I can decide what to do and not be driven by exclusively by instinct, is the image of God. It's another possibility. By the way, in case anyone is wondering, you notice that the pronoun used for God is, well, male, in this case, yes, you find female pronouns also used, but the it's plural. Let us make man, right? You know, we're supposed to be the religion of one God, right? Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, God is supposed to be one. So why is God referred to with the plural here? Sorry? God and his angels. So one suggestion that the commentators bring is that God is actually speaking to the angels at this point. Not that there's a need for a conversation, but that it's actually meant to teach human beings a lesson in humility, which is that you consult with those around you, even when you're God. So that's one idea that's brought. Another idea is simply that it's the royal we. It's God as the possessor of all powers. If you're familiar with the name for God, Elohim, so that's actually plural. It means powers. It's a reference to God as possessor of all powers. That's not unique to God in Hebrew. You find that with other words. For example, what's the word in Hebrew for water? Mayim. It's a plural word. Right? Because there's no such thing as a water, it's waters, the body of water. So it's not unique to God that you get it, but I point it out because it is jarring to see God say us instead of me. Okay, so our first explanation of the image of God is that it's the image created by God. That was Rashi. A second approach is that it is free will. A third approach, in source number 3, is that it refers to being creative, having certain powers. Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, a leading rabbi at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, writes it in source number 3. He says, the words tselem and demut, which are the words used for the image of God, are not as they sound. And he quotes a verse in Isaiah to support that idea. I'm going to skip his support and go to his second paragraph in source number 3. He says the meaning of the name Elohim, this name for God, is known. It means that he is the master of all powers. When he created all of the worlds, he created and brought them into existence, something from nothing. God created man and empowered him over myriads of myriads, innumerable forces and worlds. He gave them into the hands of man to lead them via the details of his actions, speech, and thought. In other words, dominion. The fact that what we do affects all of creation, that's how we are in the image of God. God is able to create everything, and he gives us power over things. And that's another approach. There are many more approaches we could bring. But the one that's the key for our discussion of forgiveness is the next one, from Rabbi Moshe Cordovero. Rabbi Moshe Cordovero was a Kabbalist, lived in the city of Tzfat in Israel in the 16th century. If you've ever heard of the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, who was the dominant figure of Kabbalah in the 16th century and really ever since. So his mentor at first was Rabbi Cordovero, and then the student exceeded the master. But Rabbi Cordovero wrote a work called Tomer Devorah, The Palm Tree of Devorah. And in it, among other things, he talks about the attributes of God and the way that the human being is in God's image. And what he writes in source number 4, this one line that I've excerpted, he says, the essence of the higher Tselem and Dimut, these words that are used for the form of God, the essence of it is his actions. In other words, being created in God's image means that we do what God does. Not necessarily about free will. Not necessarily about having all the power that he has. But that there are certain actions which God performs, which human beings are supposed to emulate. That's the idea. And he's going to talk about which things we're supposed to emulate in a moment. But just, I brought a couple of supporting sources. Source number 5. We are commanded biblically to walk in God's ways. In Hebrew, V'halachta bidrachav. Source number 6 from the Talmud. We're told to resemble God. Just as God is generous and merciful, so you ought to be generous and merciful. And so, if you flip the page to source number 7, you find powerful words from Rabbi Cordovero. He says, man is suited to resemble his creator. And it's a very interesting thing that he says, just with those opening words. Man is suited to resemble his creator. First of all, he says, Ha'adam in the Hebrew, man. As one mentor of mine, Rabbi Yitzchak Cohen, has pointed out, he doesn't say Jew. This is a statement about all human beings. Is suited to resemble his creator, not is obligated to. This isn't about a religious obligation. It's about what's appropriate. We are designed with the ability to resemble our creator. And he says, and then, when one does this, he achieves the secret of the higher form, Tselem and Dimut, these images of God. If he were to resemble physically, if one were to resemble God physically, meaning that you had all the tools that we've been given, which will enable us to resemble God, the ability, well, see what we're talking about, but let's say the ability to give to others. So he says, If we were to have the tools, but we weren't to resemble God in our actions, he says such a person would be making the form into a lie. Right? If you have the means of resembling God, but you don't, then all the potential is essentially a lie. It's not carried out into actuality. It broadcasts an image. It advertises to the world, look at me, but you're not. They would say of him, this is a pleasant form, but his deeds are ugly. There's a country music song, she ain't pretty, she just looks that way. So that's what it reminds me of. The essence of the higher Tselem and Dmut is in his actions. And of what good is it to be like the higher form, the form of his, quote, limbs, and to not resemble his creator in his actions? We have so much potential. We have the ability to be godlike. But if we don't act on it, if we don't bring it into action, if we don't make it real, then it's just a lot of potential. And his words are very strong. His Hebrew is much stronger than what I've done in the English. I can't carry it into the English, the weight of it. But the term he uses when he says it's a lie, making the form into a lie, the Hebrew is machziv hatsura. The word kazav is more than just a lie, it's a disappointment. It's a word that combines deceit with disappointment. We have tremendous gift and a tremendous promise, and it's for us to fulfill it. And what I'm going to contend, as Rabbi Cordovero does, is that forgiveness is very much a part of it. Forgiveness is about emulating God, and it's not about the other person. It's about being our best selves. And that gives us what I hope is a stronger motivation for forgiving. We know throughout the Torah that we have models of God forgiving. Right? Can you give me an example of when God forgives? Well, Yom Kippur is a good example, certainly, of divine forgiveness. If you jump to source number 10 for a second, you find the Torah's verse about Yom Kippur. For on this day, God will atone for you to purify you from all of your sins. Before God, you will be purified. That's one example. Where else in the Torah can you find an example of God forgiving? Yes. Right, after the golden calf, when God says, I'm going to forgive, and he teaches Moses his attributes of mercy, right, he chooses to forgive at that point. We find examples of it all over the Torah. One example that's particularly relevant for Rosh Hashanah, because it's read as the classic Torah reading for the first day of Rosh Hashanah, is, sorry, not Jonah. Jonah's Yibbe Yom Kippur is a good example also. Probably a better example than the one I'm going to bring, actually. But the story of Ishmael. Right? Ishmael, Abraham's son with Hagar, Sarah's stepson. You remember that he's kicked out of the house, right? He's now, at that stage, he's 17 years old. He's not a baby. You know, certainly in those days, in terms of what was expected of children as they grew up in that environment. But he's old enough that apparently he has become a threat to his baby brother Yitzchak, Isaac, and so he is evicted from the house. The rabbis build on the slim text we have about what he did wrong. The Hebrew text does not tell us much. And they see him as being guilty of idolatry, being guilty of some kind of game that he played with his brother Isaac, in which he pretended he was going to kill him. He was shooting arrows in his direction, all sorts of terrible behavior. And so he gets kicked out of the house. But you remember how the story develops. They're sent out with a pitcher of water. The water runs out. And then he's dehydrated. His mother puts him under a bush. And she thinks they're going to die. And then what happens? Sorry? An angel calls out to her and says, don't worry, because God has heard the voice of the youth, Basher Husham, as he is there. And so God decides to save him and to save his mother. And there's a well that she hadn't noticed before, and they survive. Take a look at source number 9 with what the Talmud does with that line when it says God has heard the voice of the youth as he is there. Talmud says a person is judged only based on his deeds of that moment. Only who you are right now. As it is written, and they quote that verse with Yishmael. And that's a really striking verse when you think about it. Because this is someone who, as the rabbis understand it, is guilty of terrible crimes, including potentially attempted murder of his baby brother. And yet, God says, who he is right now. Right now he's calling out to me. I hear him calling out to me in need. And therefore, I'm going to save him. And actually, I didn't bring the full passage. I should have brought the full passage, because the Talmud continues there. And it tells a story surrounding this. It says that when God says, I'm saving him as he is there, he's not actually answering Hagar. He's speaking to the angels. Because the angels turn to God and say, you know what his descendants are going to do to the Jewish people. And of course, the sages of the Talmud recording this don't know half of it. But they say, do you know what his descendants are going to do to the Jews? How in the world can you do this? And God's answer is, right now, is he righteous or wicked? And their answer is, he's righteous. And therefore God says, see, I have to save him. And it's a very important point, because just crying out is sufficient to gain him forgiveness for the terrible things he had done that warranted his eviction. There are loads of examples you can bring. The story of Jonah is an ideal one. There you have a prophet who rejects the idea of forgiveness, who runs away because he doesn't want to be God's agent of forgiveness for the city of Nineveh. There's obviously much more to be said about that story. But we find God forgiving throughout the Torah, so much so that it's difficult for us to understand. So why hasn't God, already brought us back to the land, brought the time of the Messiah. Like, why are we, you know, in exile then if God is so willing to forgive? And various answers are suggested, ranging from the idea that God is waiting for more Jews to ask for forgiveness, because you do have to call out, to the idea that there's a purpose to being where we are now, to the idea that God has a specific plan, a specific time, all sorts of approaches. But the bottom line out of it is, divine forgiveness doesn't come for practical reasons. It isn't because God feels stress and anger and wants to release it and not, you know, be stressed. It's not because God has a need for, you know, a future relationship. It's not about that. It's because of God's own nature. God's attributes are attributes of mercy and forgiveness. That's what the Torah is trying to teach us. If you take a look at source number 11, the book of Daniel, it gives us a very concise description of the traits that he considers to be God's traits. When the Torah wants to teach us about who God is, he says mercy and forgiveness are with God. That's who God is supposed to be. And here, actually, another interesting point that comes with it. Anyone know what the word in Hebrew is for mercy? Rachamim, right. Heard someone say? Rachamim is the word in Hebrew for mercy. What's the word in Hebrew for a womb? Rechem is the word in Hebrew for a womb. That's correct. Take a look, please, at source number 12. Don Isaac Abarbanel, writing in the 15th century. He says, because the mother has great mercy for her children, therefore they call mercy rachamim, from rechem, the womb, which is uniquely female. Going back to those who had asked about masculine pronouns for God, it's more complex than that. But the idea is to be like the womb, in the sense that a mother has unique affection for a child. The child who she bore, the child who she nursed, the child who she nurtured through those early years, that's a unique relationship in which the mother wants to give to the child. That's seen as the ultimate in mercy, and that becomes the word for mercy in Hebrew. Yes? That's a dangerous sentence, isn't it? And make sure the kid doesn't know that. Yes. No, but you're right. We associate mothers with mercy, and more so than the father. Yeah, the biblical text has this very interesting flip. There are two commandments to children regarding their relationship with their parents. One commandment is to honor your parents, and the other one is to have awe or fear of parents. And in both cases, the verse mentions both the mother and the father, but it changes the order. When it comes to honor, it says, "Kabed et avicha ve'imecha," honor your father and mother. When it comes to awe or fear, it says, "Ish imo ve'aviv tira'u," you should fear your mother and father, puts the mother first. And the commentators say, it's the one for whom it's counterintuitive. It's easy to honor our mothers, easier than it is to honor our fathers, because honor is understood as a closer relationship. Whereas it's easier often for children to fear the father than it is for them to fear the mother. And we can go on and on about gender stereotypes and atypical families and so on. That's not the point. The point is that, yes, within the human race, historically, we have associated the mother and the giving nature of the mother with mercy. And that's a very important point, which, frankly, is worthy of expansion as well. But I wanted to make sure to see the next point here. Rabbi Cordovero goes on to discuss, after saying that we're supposed to emulate God, he talks about God's 13 attributes of mercy. Now, there are actually two times in Scripture in which we are presented with 13 attributes of mercy that God has. One of them is after the golden calf. That's the one that's more familiar to people. I think it's the one that gets quoted in the liturgy. It goes, Hashem, Hashem, Kel, Rachum, V'chanun, Erech Apayim, Rav Chesed. And there's a nice song that people sing it to. It's repeated quite often in the liturgy for Yom Kippur. That's one. But there's a second one. It appears at the end of the prophet, Micha. And it's actually read in the liturgy once a year. It actually comes up in Slichot liturgy also separately, but the one that I think people may be more familiar with is in Tashlich. The word Tashlich comes from those verses. If you take a look at source number 13, I brought you the first of the verses. There's actually three verses, but this is the beginning of the verses in which he presents the 13 attributes. The prophet Micha says, "Who is powerful like you, God, who pardons iniquity and overlooks transgression for the remnant of his heritage? He does not maintain his wrath forever, for he desires generosity." That's the beginning of it. And these verses are broken down into 13 attributes of mercy. The one that involves the word tashlich is actually later, so you won't see it in this verse, in source number 13, but it's where the prophet says, "V'tashlich v'mitzulot yam kol chatotam," you, God, will cast into the depths of the seas all of their sins. So that's why it gets invoked, the tashlich. Yes? What do you think?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I find that mercy is a stronger form of forgiveness than, while I'm only talking about myself, mercy I would apply to a very, very serious offense that I was forgiving, and regular forgiving. I hope I'm making some sense here.
So,
are mercy and forgiveness interchangeable?
I mean, to my mind, mercy is an attribute and forgiveness is an action, right? It can be
something that an attribute.
Yeah, it's a characteristic.
And forgiveness is something you do.
That's the way I would take it. Yeah,
no,
I mean,
it's not a verb.
I don't think of it that way.
I was thinking of it as something you feel.
Right. I mean,
like as a joke, when you're disciplining a child. My son used to say, "Have mercy on me."
What were you doing?
So they're not interchangeable, they're entirely.
I mean, it would make a nice bumper sticker, "Mercy is a verb," you know? As a statement to people to act on, you know, to act on feelings of mercy. And you can call somebody forgiving if they have that trait of being somebody who forgives. And in that sense, forgiveness can be a trait. But generally speaking, mercy leads to forgiveness. That's the way I would, that's the way that I would look at it. In terms of Tashlich also, since I mentioned it, you may be aware, Tashlich isn't actually about throwing bread in the water. I grew up thinking that that was what it was. You take bread and you go out to, you know, to throw it in the water on Rosh Hashanah. No stranger or less strange than any other Jewish custom. But that's actually not what it's about. It's about that verse in Micha in which we are told that God will cast our sins into the sea. And so what we're doing is acting that out, not with bread, but by going and reciting this prayer by a body of water. In truth, the bread thing seems to have been some kind of recent innovation, like the last 100 or 200 years, to amuse the kids. If you speak to Jews, for example, from Iran, their practice is, Persian Jews will go to a body of water and shake the corner of their cloak, as if to say we're shaking out whatever's, you know, been with us. I've asked Russian Jews, they have no familiarity with this idea of throwing bread. It was, you know, invented by parents who needed something for their kids to do. So here's something for the kids to do. Go throw the bread. Yes?
Everything
forgivable? The question was, is everything forgivable? The short answer is no. And I'm going to come back to it. So hold me to that, but I want to come back to that point. It's a good point. It goes back also to Betty's question from before. So take a look at source number 14, please. Because source number 14 is the key to tying all of this together. Right? We talked about the question of why forgive. We talked about practical benefits of forgiving. We then said we're going to look for a stronger motivation for forgiving. We said that as part of a tangent to get us there, we talked about what it means to be created in God's image, presented a few different ideas. Is it free will? Is it the powers that God has? And then suggested from Rabbi Cordovero, it's the fact that we have the ability to emulate divine actions. And now what Rabbi Cordovero wants to do is take us through the 13 attributes of mercy and show how human beings can emulate them to fulfill our promise of being in the image of God. Being in the image of God, living in the image of God, means carrying out these 13 attributes. And I want to show you the first. We're not going through all 13, but I want to show you the first, which I believe is very powerful. And will bring us back to the question of, is everything forgivable? Source number 14. He's commenting on the beginning of the verse where Micha turns to God and says, who is powerful like you, God? So he says, when you say to God, who is powerful like you, that's not a statement of, wow, God is really powerful. It's actually a statement about a way in which God does not use the power that is at his disposal. Take a look at 14. He says, you know, there was never a person who sinned against God without God at that very instant flowing into him his existence, his ability to move his limbs. Right? Judaism teaches that God is giving us the strength to function at every moment. Well, what that means is that if someone does something they shouldn't be doing, God is enabling them to do that. The thief who is reaching to the shelf to take something that's not his, you know, is being powered by God. The person who is saying something unkind about somebody else is being powered by God. And so on for all various sins people can list. And so he says, no one has ever sinned against God without God at that same moment giving him the ability to do so. Even though that person sins with that force, God does not withhold it at all. God endures this shame. It's a very strong idea. The idea that he is giving me the ability to do this, and he's not taking it away. What it actually reminds me of, and I don't want to get into political discussions in any way, shape, or form, but it sort of reminds me of the conversations every time there's a war in Gaza, and people say, you know, we're sending them electricity. Yeah, while they're fighting against us and using the electricity to be able to create the weapons and power the weapons that they're shooting at us with, we are sending them the electricity. We're sending them the heat. We're sending them the water. Again, that's its own discussion. But just that's what this image reminds me of God giving the person the ability to do everything that that person is actually doing at that very moment. Yes? Anything but Israel and Gaza. Oh, yeah. No, it's not that he's making us do it. It's that he is giving us the ability. He's putting the fuel at our disposal. Yeah. No, it's that's true. And, you know, figuring out how that blends with divine omniscience is a good question. But yes, that's the idea. He's giving us the ability that we then choose to use however we decide. It's the idea of God being what is called a soveil. What's the word in Hebrew for savla? Well, that was just, I just said it. The word in Hebrew for patience is savlanut. To be soveil is to endure a burden, and yet to be patient. And that's what we see here, is the idea of God being a soveil. He endures. And what Rabbi Cordovero is trying to tell us is that's the expectation for us. The expectation for us is to say, even when somebody sins against us, using the power we have given to them, nonetheless to say, I'm going to bear it. I'm even going to forgive it. And that is a very demanding standard. Let's not kid ourselves. It's hard enough to forgive people when we didn't, you know, help them beforehand. But when we've helped them and we've given them the position that they're in and they turn around and use that against us, that's a very hard thing. But that's what Rabbi Cordovero is saying, is what it means to be in the image of God, to develop that trait. And nowhere is this more relevant than parents and children. When you give the children everything they have, and then, as happens, they turn it against you. Now, that doesn't mean that it should really be unlimited. To go back to the question of, will parents really forgive everything? Will a mother really forgive everything for the child? It's not necessarily healthy for the child, for the parent to simply wipe away everything and say, it's over, it's as though it never happened. But I heard a lecture by Rabbi Moshe Weinberger of New York in which he emphasized this point. He says, there's a difference between holding a child to account. I'm sorry. There's a difference between forgiving. I want to make sure that I say it properly. There's a difference between holding a child to account for wrong and disengaging. Holding a child to account for wrong may be healthy for the child. That may be necessary, and even if that means being harsh. But that's okay. Disengaging, saying, I'm not going to be so vile, I'm not going to be patient anymore, I don't want anything to do with you anymore, that's the line. That's the line one doesn't cross. And that was Rabbi Weinberger's point, and I think it holds true in terms of what we're saying here. The idea of supporting people and helping people, including our children, even as they do something that we feel is wrong, even as it's something that hurts, and being able to forgive that is within the capacity of the human being. That's part of what it means to be godlike. That's the idea. Now, I come back to the question that was asked before. Separate from the category of children, are there things that are unforgivable? Are there things where you should say, no, I can't forgive? The answer is yes, meaning one should not live in an abusive situation. If a person is in danger, physical abuse, verbal abuse, whatever it is, then, yeah, end that situation, get out of that situation. One should not mistake forgiveness for self-destruction. Right? There does, even though forgiveness is as valuable as it is and as important as it is, our lives come first. So that's a very important line to cross. There's also, or line to draw, I should say. There's also the fact that sometimes forgiveness isn't good for the person. Sometimes you recognize that the person isn't yet sincere, doesn't really understand, and needs to first understand what they've done wrong in order to avoid doing it in the future. It's tricky, because that puts you in the position of being the teacher of the other person, and that may not be the best role. So the caveats are important. There are, you know, there are limits. But the overall goal is to reach this stage in our emulation of God in which we're going to say, I forgive, not only on a basic level, but I even forgive when this person has turned my help against me. Yes?
Would forgiveness also be kind of being a martyr? Oh, I am forgiving. Okay, I'm doing it because I'm suffering so bad. I'm a martyr. But let it go, and you are not really free with your forgiveness.
Right. So I think it is important to be whole in one's forgiveness, especially because if you tell the other person, you know, that you don't want to, when you tell the other person I'm being a martyr, that's kind of defeating the purpose. But yeah, this is a goal. This is something to work towards. Yeah. One thing I should emphasize, I had a column in the CJN last month. I don't know if you saw it on faith. One of the points that I made at the end of the column was that attributes are things we work towards. I was talking about faith there. You know, it's not that a person has to say either I believe or I don't believe, I've decided that this is where I am for life. We work towards a goal. And I think that's true in this also. a person who doesn't have it in them right now to say, I'm just going to forgive everybody and walk away from it and be good with it and be comfortable with it, is not a failure. Being like this, fulfilling our capacity to be godlike, is something we strive to attain. And sometimes we achieve it, and sometimes we fall back, and sometimes we achieve it again. But it's a goal. It's not an ongoing state of being. Yes?
Does this include forgiving Hitler?
No. I mean, as far as I know, he hasn't apologized. Forgiveness is not something. Sorry? Yeah.
I think overall, what we are saying, forgiving the Shoah, which Eileen brought up, she said to me, how can you forgive that?
Right. But
how can we as Jews forgive that?
Right. But I think that there are a couple of points that I should make in that regard. First is that I can't forgive what has been done to somebody else. So I can't forgive the murderer and the torture and everything else, for a kid born in 1972. I can't, it's not for me to forgive. It's not, let them go ask their victims. That's number one. Number two, as a broader point in general for forgiveness, forgiveness generally does involve somebody apologizing. To apologize, and apologizing in Judaism, the process of tshuva, of repentance, requires trying to make people whole, to correct things, to ensure that you're not going to do it again, and so on. Like, it's a process. It's not a simple and straightforward thing. We've talked about giving forgiveness. We haven't talked about seeking it. I wouldn't go there in terms of applying this there. That's not, that, yeah, I don't think it applies to them. Yes. I go back to the point about not forgiving when one is in a dangerous situation, and I think that forgiving someone who is attacking you, qualifies. I wouldn't recommend it for that.
But isn't forgiveness a two-way? Forgive and someone has to accept your forgiveness. No.
Why do they have to accept my forgiveness?
Then why would you even forgive?
Right, because it's about my trait. The forgiveness is about me being godlike. It's not about whether they want to be forgiven or not. That, again, that doesn't mean I expose myself to harm.
Be a really good person
from somebody else.
Someone doesn't care. Right?
Maybe. There's when you get into the context of forgiveness for the Holocaust, you're in a whole other category.
I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about relationships. I'm thinking more on something that is at our level now. Okay, we're coming to Rosh Hashanah, and at that time, and you ask people that you've been brightest with and have had strongest with, This is the time to do it. But doesn't it have to be a given? You can just forgive, and that person can just. I don't know whether I could forgive someone if that person at the other end wouldn't accept it.
Right, that's what I'm saying. I had mentioned before that the other person has to ask, but the truth of the matter is it's not necessarily so. I think that part of this really is achieving that point of being forgiving without the person coming to you. Yeah, I think so. It's hard. I'm not pretending otherwise. But that's our potential. Our potential as human beings, created with the ability to be in the image of God, as explained by Rabbi Cordovero, is for us to be forgiving. For us to be able to say, I'm going to go past it, to be loving as though they were from our womb, as we said regarding Rachamim and Rechem, and to support others and to bear what they do, even as they flout us. It's a very hard thing. It's not simple and it's not straightforward, and I'm not pretending otherwise. And each person in their own life circumstances has endured situations that, you know, are a real challenge in this regard, and I'm not, you know, taking that lightly. At the same time, that's the idea. To go back to, you know, the story of Rabbi Frand and the newspaper, right? To get the neighbor the paper for practical purposes, and to get the neighbor the paper in order to be surveilled, in order to say, I am going to endure. And the goal ultimately is to create a world in which that woman who I mentioned in the beginning, who shredded the $100,000, right, would have been able to forgive, let her give away the money to some charity, but would have been able to get past the tremendous pain that she was receiving from her kids. I hope we will all work somehow towards forgiveness, granted to each other, and God willing, be inscribed and sealed for a wonderful new year.